Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by James Norrington. How are you doing, James?
I'm very well, John. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. You've written the cover feature this week?
Yes, indeed.
Excellent. Tackling one of the big market myths that we're dealing with at the moment.
Yes, yeah, the active-passive debate, which shouldn't really be a debate.
Absolutely. We've knocked that one out of the park, and we'll never talk about it again after this. Algie Hall, how are you doing, Algie?
Very well, thanks.
And you're here in lieu of Jonas this week.
Yes, I am the Jonas stand-in.
Excellent, because we need to talk about house builders.
We do.
We really do. We've had a lot of news in the last couple of weeks, and not all of it's good.
No, I mean, it's a very popular sector. It was a real darling of a sector, probably till around the start of this year. A lot of people still were setting a lot of store by it. But I think nerves have started to creep in, and it's kind of being substantiated, some of that worry now. We've had updates and results from Crest Nicholson, Bartley, and also McCarthy and Stone.
I think we had some from Bovis as well, which wasn't so
bad. Which is why I'm not mentioning it.
Yeah, well, no, it doesn't really fit the story.
Although in some ways it does, because I think certain parts of the market are stronger than others.
Yes, absolutely.
Essentially.
I mean, let's crack on with house builders. I think this is the thing. You know, lots of our readership would have got into house builders and done very well out of them.
Oh, yeah.
I think the wind started to come out of the sails after the referendum.
Valuations have been very high in the sector, which has caused nervousness, and everyone knows it's very cyclical and profits vary a lot, top of the cycle versus bottom of the cycle.
So let's start with that, because Barclay this week have basically said, yes, profit, you know, the numbers look great in their results, mm-hmm. But this is as good as it gets.
Yes, essentially we're past the peak. I mean, and also, the interesting thing about Barclay, they came out with such a clear plan to how they'd handle the next cycle when the cycle began, that now they're just managing their way through it, that we know almost how they're going to play this. They're still returning capital. They're making the most out of the markets they're in. But it's the situation clearly isn't so good. Planning's got more difficult with the mayor that we have now.
Because Bartley's focused on London, primarily.
Because it's focused on, London, and the South Eastern, but London's a big focus.
I mean, that's quite an interesting thing to observe. Planning's got more difficult, yet we have this house building crisis, you know, where there was a massive shortage. Well, you would have thought that the powers that be were doing everything that, doing everything they could to make the planning process easier.
I think the thing to appreciate, and this kind of plays into the Bovis point, our housing crisis isn't about not having enough luxury flats selling for astronomical amounts. It's about having actual affordable accommodations. If you remember, we went from a situation where there had to be a lot more affordable housing in every scheme to one where there didn't have to be so much. And, you know, so it's just, you know, these it's a question about how you approach the situation. But a house builder like Berkeley, which is building for the very top end, it's lots of investors are interested, and people who are very wealthy and will, you know, we'll get property elsewhere.
Yeah, because I mean, I look at Barclays share price, and actually, you know, this mm-hmm. year it looks all right. I mean, compared to some of the other house building share price graphs, this is going the right way still.
It's a real quality player. We know it's going to be looking to return capital to shareholders. It's not going to, you know, chase land prices up and things like that. Or that seems to be, you know, the roadmap it's outlined, and it's just doing everything it said it would. Whilst people may be disappointed that they're saying we're past the peak now, they're actually handling the cycle in a very shrewd way, it still looks.
And one of the main attractions of house building shares recently has been these special returns of capital, these special dividends. Mm-hmm. And Barclay's going to continue with its planned program of extra returns to shareholders.
Yes, yeah.
And that's important.
And it's important not only because it's money in shareholders' pockets, because it means it won't overextend, which is the classic mistake builders make. They buy huge amounts of land at the top of the cycle, get ready to build loads and loads of houses, and suddenly no one wants to buy any houses, and they've got all this massive amount of asset on their balance sheet, which isn't worth anything like it used to be worth.
But you could argue that, I mean, the builders, they would have learned their lesson from the financial crisis, where that's exactly what they did. They overextended, yes, yeah. Got themselves in all sorts of financial...
I mean, they do do it every cycle, though. You've got to remember, they tend to learn...
haven't done it quite so badly this time around.
So
I mean, they're not going out
around.
Buying huge amounts of speculative land.
No, I mean, land values have really, you know, not run away yet, if they're going to at all.
But they are ex-growth. In a sense, they're ex-growth. They're now becoming income-wise.
Well, and I think Cress Nicholson's really, you know, exemplifies what people are, you know, concerned about. I mean, what no one,
because that is
what
an no one, that is an ugly share price graph.
That is, and they've had downgrades all throughout the year. There were some hopes, I think, in March when they had a trading update that actually, you know, things were leveling off. But then there've been a whole raft of new downgrades now. I mean, they're facing rising costs, tougher end markets, and a squeeze on margins is a consequence. And people just aren't confident in what they're saying because they keep on coming out with these warnings.
I mean, Cress Nicholson is a mass house builder, so
yeah,
the kind of estates you see popping up, you know, all over the country.
Yes, yeah, but probably less exposed to or less able to benefit from Help to Buy, which is a thing which is kind of really keeping other house builders afloat who are down that end of the market. It's so supporting prices.
Explain the difference. What is it that Cress Nicholson's doing that means it's not really benefiting from this Help to Buy tailwind?
Well, with the builders, it's just a mix of what they're selling, and generally, if something's more affordable, then you're going to benefit from Help to Buy.
So Help to Buy is really aimed
supporting
at
the buyer.
First time buyer market as much as anything else.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, we've moved both Bartley and Cress Nicholson to hold. The latest news from the sector was McCarthy and Stone, which is slightly different.
Slightly different beast, yeah. Because it's retirement apartments and homes. They've got other issues. I mean, the slowing housing market is a problem because it means the people who would be moving into their properties can't sell these large houses that they probably, you know, had a family in.
And they definitely don't qualify for Help to Buy. So there's no tailwind for the houses
that
McCarthy's would-be customers might be selling.
No, absolutely. There's no government support really coming through for anyone. And then also McCarthy have they sell on the freeholds because there's a whole issue with ground rents at the moment. The government looking to basically curb what's been viewed by some as the exploitation of people in leasehold properties.
Well, some other builders have already kind of, you know, fessed up to this. And
yes, yeah. This is a profitable stream of income for them, which is potentially being removed.
And I think McCarthy and Stone are seeking an exemption from this particular investigation on the basis that they're providing some kind of, you know, a service providing retirement properties.
Although they are, yeah, they do sell the ground rents on.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I've actually, funny enough, looked at these flats. Not for me. I'm not that old yet. I'm only the same age as you, Algie.
Yeah, well,
you look
editing
about 10,
the,
you look about
the
10
IC
years younger. No, I looked for my father-in-law, and yeah, they are very expensive flats. And you pay a lot on the... On the service charges. Well, if you go for one of what they call, I think they call it a lifestyle package. And as far as I understand it, they're exploring other tenure options. So these were flats you bought on a leasehold basis. Now they're looking at rental options and part ownership options.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this strategic review they've announced.
Strategic review.
Well, yeah. Which, in other words, our business model isn't working like we'd like it to. What are we going to do? And obviously that's a cause for lots of nervousness with investors because there is this strategic review that then resets expectations about what returns this business. I'm not saying necessarily McCarthy and Stone, but what returns a business will make in the future.
Yeah, I must admit, I look at this one and I'm slightly troubled by this. I mean, I actually think that, you know, Help to Buy has supported, and I've written this in my editorial this week, Help to Buy has been there to support first-time buyers. But actually, there is a very large market of people who are moving into retirement or through retirement and looking to downsize. And McCarthy and Stone should be in a sweet spot.
Well, yeah. I mean, all the demographic evidence and the evidence about the actual supply of purpose-built retirement accommodation suggests totally in the long term, this is a great market. But it's actually how...
a great market. And this is why...
How's it working now?
Well, a great market, absolutely. The demographics are there. And this is why I look at McCarthy and Stone and think, you've got this wrong.
Well, yeah,
because you should be you know, doing extremely well given the trends that are there.
Or is it that, or is it just that the property market's become, you know, it's kind of the wealth that's been created, and it means the people at the top just can't find buyers.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see how that's a possibility, hence why they're looking to change their model. I'm also slightly concerned, and you know, Graham and I were talking, Graham Davis, our digital editor, were talking about some of the schemes in Essex, which I alluded to in my editorial last week. And we found a site out near Graham, which is fully sold. And when we looked in more detail, there's a lot of what they call home exchange or part exchange going on. So the builder seems to be taking on the role of the buyer of the purchases that people are trying to to get rid of.
McCarthy and Stone offers part exchange,
And they do that, yeah. So
it's kind of a balance sheet, which is always an issue for a house builder because they have to have such massive balance sheets to do business. Then you've adding more risk into that balance sheet through actually buying secondhand properties. It's another layer of risk.
I don't think the numbers are huge right now. So I think when I looked, McCarthy and Stone had about 32 million quid of part exchange property on their balance sheet, which doesn't sound like a very large number in the grand scheme of a company like this. But it's gone from nothing like 2 years ago, 18 months ago. And you just wonder, you know, it just seems to me a sign that, you know, these incentives are increasingly important to drive the housing market. And government largesse has been very important in driving the housing
market.
And you just wonder how long it can continue.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big... Everyone's got their opinion, or multiple opinions in my case.
So, Algie, as tips editor, what do we think of house builders? I mean, generally, if I, you know, if one of the team come along and say, right, I really want to buy this...
Well, I think it depends on, you know, what they're doing. I mean, I think a lot of the regeneration companies, Jonas has been finding very interesting cases.
So like for them. You and I, for example?
Yeah, exactly. That Harworth he wrote about the other day,
which is the old UK coal.
Which just has ridiculous amounts of land. But, I mean, they're generating real value from it in a fairly stagnant real estate market. And, you know, anyone who's... benefiting from Help to Buy, which I think runs till 2021, from memory. So, that is a support.
But these companies tend to be outside London and the southeast. Their sweet spot tends to be,
regional. Yeah, in Midlands often, in the north. The thing is, we're past the peak of the cycle. The really exciting part of the cycle for house builders is when they've been completely flattened, they're not making any money, you know, they've had a big rights issue, you know, they everything's gone to the wall, and then they rebuild and the margins just take off, the rating, you know, it does that completely perverse thing of being next to nothing at the bottom, and then just when it should be, you know, high pricing in the recovery, but then it kind of expands to, you know, the good times are going to last forever kind of ratings. And yes, and we're definitely towards the, you know, the high point, it seems.
So you've got to
we're
be much
going
more
late cycle.
You've got to be much more selective,
and a lot more selective.
I think James, talking to you about the Alpha report we published on house builders, which you've taken over the editing duties for. I mean, the conclusion of that report that Jonas wrote was exactly the same. That the value is in the fringes, in these interesting little companies.
There is still room for growth. That was the title of the report. So it's but it's not a case of buying the whole sector as it might have been a couple of years ago.
So it's really a stock picker's game.
I suppose, you know, what you could say also from that stock picking perspective is you look at a company like Crest, and arguably it's quite cheap at the moment. Or not, if you're prepared to have a kind of a more benign view of the market, if you think it's going to, sure, we're late cycle, you're not going to get all that excitement, but things aren't going to fall off a cliff. It's going to kind of, you know, trundle on quite nicely, the housing market. If you want to take that point of view, then there's definitely an argument to say a company like Crest, which has been really punished for its profits warnings, you know, is a kind of contrarian buy. But but again, you could be catching a falling knife.
Yeah, that would be a very brave contrarian buy, I would suggest. Actually, this ties into your stock screen this week, this discussion around house builders, Algie, which is your small cap genuine value.
Yes,
screen.
Yeah.
Because one of the companies that popped out of this screen this week is a company called Forterra.
Yes,
which is a brick maker.
Yeah, yeah, and I've taken the line that with, you know, with these issues in the house building sector. But, you know, there's still a housing shortage and, you know, you go picks and shovels. And, you know, a company like Forte, I mean, the brickmakers, actually, I mean, it's a very interesting industry because there are hardly any, only about three of them of any note, control about 90% of the market. And you can't get planning for brickmaking sites very easily at all. So there's no real new competition coming in. Imports are more expensive than domestically produced bricks. And so really, there's as long as demand's going up, which if the government's to get anywhere near its target for, you know, 300,000 housing starts a year, then, you know, building's got to increase massively. And we mainly build with bricks in the UK. Then, you know, these guys should be making serious money. And the margins they make. I mean, I actually, because not being too familiar with Forterra, just looking at the margins this company makes, it's incredible. It's near 20% margin for making bricks. So then you know, it's you know, it's a very valuable.
In the report as well on house builders, we did a small screen on the just a sector screen on the building suppliers as well, and they look pretty good. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it's all in there if you're an Alpha subscriber.
Must admit, I'm in the process of trying to build a little extension at the moment. I need 1,000 bricks. And they're really expensive.
Getting quick. They're only getting pricier.
They are so expensive. It's unbelievable.
Well, yeah, no, it's. I mean, it's an interesting thing, but I mean, it's also, you know, these stocks, they're cheap on the metric I looked at, but Forterra is the most expensive stock from the screen, so they're not screamingly cheap. Well, so, necessarily.
I mean, it's an interesting screen. It's done well over the years, not so well last year compared to the market, but I mean, just tell us the principles about this this particular screen, LG, and who actually came out looking best.
So this screen, it looks for reasonably priced growth, or it looks for cheap growth. So it's a bit like, it uses a ratio, a bit like a PEG ratio, but it takes into account how much cash or debt a company has and what dividends it's paying.
This is your genuine value ratio.
This is a genuine value screen.
TM Algy Hall.
I feel so, whenever I give a ratio a title, because I can't find anyone else kind of necessarily using it. I mean, probably so, I'm sure lots of people do, but I kind of give it a title and I kind of cringe when I have to rewrite it because I always get overexcited. And so genuine value. So it's a souped up PEG ratio, really. So it looks for that. It looks for good forecast earnings growth, but nothing too outlandish, you know, in a reasonably finance balance sheet, a bit of share price momentum.
And you've fine tuned it this year with another test, haven't you?
But yeah, this year I've I did this for the large version. I mean, because it's a growth screen, I found the screens which I run, which use earnings revisions. So that's if a broker forecast, let's say he or she was forecasting for, you know, 2020. You follow what those forecasts for 2020 do over, you know, a certain time period, and they'll either go up or down.
But these are our staircase graphs that we like.
Yes, exactly. So it's been very powerful, it seems, just looking for stocks where those forecasts have been increased a lot over a time period. So I've just introduced that so that rather than looking at companies which look like they're offering growth at very good value, but the growth is actually not really going to come through because forecasts have been coming down, I'm just focusing more with this screen on the companies where forecasts have been going up.
Earnings upgrade cycle,
yeah, indeed.
Magic words. So the best company that came out of this screen was T. Clark.
The cheapest.
Cheapest.
And the cheapest is not necessarily the best. Because T. Clark, it's interesting just to write it up because there's so many things about this company which you just think, oh, no, well, no wonder it's so cheap. So I think my first line is investors are never likely to want to pay up for a low margin cyclical company that has to manage the risk associated with carrying large working capital items.
So I remember this company. It used to be an electrician.
Well, like, it is basically. So, I mean, but what it's done is it does fit out. So, you know, the electricals, you know, and, you know, all those bits and bobs. But it's become very specialist because the requirements of fit out are becoming, you know, so much more complicated. With, you know, companies want to be far more digitalized and, you know, health and safety, etc. It does seem like it's being able to, you know, its tiny margins are being pushed up. So it's kind of introduced a margin target to take its operating margin from 2.7% to 3%, which obviously is tiny. But I mean, you know, there's so many, you know, costs involved just with, you know, doing fit out. that, you know, explains tiny margins, but it means lots can go wrong if anything goes wrong. Anyway. Kind of managing that process.
Sorts of ideas.
Not necessarily
a buy recommendation.
Yeah, exactly. You know, these ideas will not be for everyone. But I mean, but then, you know, a company like T. Clark, you can imagine it being re-rated fairly substantially from, you know, the current forward P of 6x. It's, you know, that tells you about the risk involved. But people, you know, during a cycle, people start to overlook risk quite often. You see large re-ratings from these kind of stocks. You just kind of, they're not forever stocks, really, unless you're going to completely close your eyes and
you say that,
cross your fingers.
I covered this company more than a decade ago.
Yes, right.
I mean, it's a survivor.
No, I don't mean the business won't be around forever. I just mean it's not like Unilever.
Written about them this week as well. You might have some decisions to make there if the old move to Holland goes ahead.
Well, that's quite a big thing.
It is quite a big thing. Let's thank you, Algie. Let's move over to the cover feature now, James, which is excellent, which you've written this week. And it's a debate that we've had many times in the office, which has been happening more broadly. And it's the idea that active management has had its day and that we should be buying ETFs. And I think what we've concluded is that there is much more to this discussion than is being said.
I think fundamentally, good active managers do still add value. And also for a self-directed Investors Chronicle reader, don't give up hope. Being a good stock picker can still, you know, make you a lot of money in the long term.
So why has this come about? I mean, ETFs are cheap. And I say ETFs, but when it's more passive, and that would include tracker funds as well. But ETFs have become a huge, huge market for assets under management. Why is this discussion being framed the way it is?
In a word, money. I think it's $5 trillion worth under management in ETFs now. It's obviously it's a huge competition. That money's going from somewhere. It's coming from active. In some cases, obviously, there are net outflows of active going into passive. So it's people fighting over the same slice of revenue, really.
And the active management industry, or certainly parts of the active management industry, haven't exactly done themselves any favours over the years.
No, I mean, we've had MiFID II coming in, which is a lot of that's about transparency of fees, performance and suitability for investors. And you know, a lot of the active fund industry has made a rod for their own backs by charging people too much for too little in the past. But that's not to say that, you know, that everyone's been bad. I mean, what I've done in the feature is I looked at a measure called the information ratio, which actually measures the returns. It's a measure of risk return based on the deviation from a benchmark, which shows, you know, how an active manager is adding value. And of the majority of funds that I surveyed, most of the active managers had positive information ratios, which meant that they were adding value.
Okay, but active managers are often criticised for high fees. I mean, does the information ratio take that into consideration?
Well, it doesn't as a ratio, but the data I took was performance net of fees. So in our survey, it was net of fees. So actually, 135 active funds that I surveyed for the UK over the last 12 months, they actually had positive information ratio, which basically means they were adding value for money.
Okay, so this is interesting. So now we've sort of created a bit of a level playing field here. And I guess what we're trying to say is it's horses for courses. There are certain things that you may want to go active for, certain things that ETFs do better.
I mean, I'm a fan of ETFs. I think it's democratised the investing landscape. It allows people to get access to whole of markets. But that's what they primarily should be used for, is a cheap way to get access to a whole market. What investing passively in a market, I don't know, Chris Dillow's a big fan of it. It's basically what it enables you to do is to capture certain premiums that you might miss as an active. In the UK, for example, I've written in the feature, momentum has been the biggest risk premium. We hear a lot about smart beta ETFs, target momentum. Actually, smart beta is probably, I'm a bit more sceptical of some of the smart beta strategies.
I think you described it as a dumb alpha in the feature, didn't you?
It's not my term, but it's been.
Okay.
I've written about smart beta in the past, and that shows that passive industry is actually being a bit disingenuous about the benefits of active by effectively trying to replicate some of the benefits of active in a passive way. And so that's probably why people have fought back and called it dumb alpha, because when it can go wrong, factor investing can go very wrong.
And you do pay more for those types of
funds. Yeah, and you pay more anyway.
Well,
exactly. You know, those can actually be more expensive than some mutual funds.
So ETFs, you know, for example, if you wanted to use something to track the US market, That's the way.
Yeah, well, historically, the S&P 500, it's been very difficult for active managers to consistently outperform, and it's a cheap and easy way to track. But the main return, the QE regime, which ended in 2014, it was sort of quality stocks and income stocks went up steadily, very low volatility. That continued for a couple of years after the Fed ended its QE program with an accommodative rate policy, which is being tightened now, of course. But those big stocks, when they're going up steadily, it's very difficult to outperform.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are instances where you've argued in the feature that active actually is better.
Yes, I think in falling markets, active managers can add value.
I guess that's something we should be thinking about quite seriously right now. I mean, we've had some serious wobbles this week, and
been a nervy market definitely this year.
Absolutely, the markets are sitting at all time highs. So is now the time to be sitting on a passive strategy?
Well, I mean, I think that we've just gone through the stock screens. You could passively, take a smart beta approach and buy everything in Algy stock screens, but I don't think he would advocate doing that. So,
well, if someone's prepared to take the risk, I mean, this is in fact something I find so interesting about people's comparisons between active and passive is that there just seems to be a complete oversight of the behavioral aspect to this, which is that if active strategies will not outperform all the time, if they're properly active, they will underperform the market for periods. It's like the long-term outperformance, which is what you're going for. But what happens in the fund management industry is as soon as someone starts underperforming for, not very long, I mean, think of Neil Woodford, this amazing long-term record, suddenly money flows out. It's leaving the door. And that active strategy, if it is worth its salt, it will come back. But it'll come back with far less money invested behind it, because all that money will rush to the next hot strategy, which is just about to fall off a cliff because, grand runs can't be sustained. So when people look at active, they're looking at this behavioural thing, this kind of performance chasing. So it's like, the comparisons that people make are kind of fairly loony in a way because, You're looking at movements of money as well as the actual integrity of the active strategy, which is actually what people should be interested in, and then they should try and find a way of behaving in a sensible way when it comes to investing.
I mean, if we had active managers who kind of changed their strategy with the wind, you would kind of question what they're doing.
Well, yeah, no, exactly.
And they're the bad ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also that's what the market does. I mean, the individual active managers, so you can have, the good active managers can be there and consistent, but their funds will be shut down because no one's interested. You look at the period of underperformance of value recently, and there just aren't very many value investors left in the game. And if value starts to outperform again, active management will look silly because everyone's in growth, but that's not because, active management doesn't work. It's just the way money flows. People behave, very foolishly with their money by chasing performance a lot of the time.
Which is, one of the arguments for passive is to take that emotion out of it for buying buying the market. But it's really sort of, I think I come to a conclusion in the future, really, it's best to take an agnostic approach that you can have passive make a very good, cheap core holding for a lot of asset classes and a lot of regions. But you'll also want to believe in something and back an active manager or back yourself to pick certain stocks to change your weighting as well.
And I think you talk about some areas of some asset classes where active actually will, where you can't see how a passive approach could be an active manager because of the very nature of how you must invest in those sectors.
Talking about property as an asset class, I mean, if I was speculating purely on the direction of real estate prices, then passive vehicles are okay. But in reality, if you're a
why would you even do that?
It's daft. I mean, you might as well. That's just speculating on anything. I'd rather sort of have somebody managing with property. It's we've looked at with the companies we've spoken about. There's such variation in regions, business models. We've got different rent models for real estate and different types of customers. So all of that needs oversight.
Yeah, we've had some of our events and fantastic property managers, and they talk about active management. When they're talking about active management, they're talking about literally managing a property at the ground level. And it's extraordinary the how close they are to the coalface of managing the properties that are in their books. It's extraordinary. So, yeah, I think that's a really great example of where active managers do add a lot of value. Bonds, I think, is something else
fixed income. So fixed income, I like for short duration bonds, so high quality liquid issues, of buying an ETF for say, you know, one to 3 year duration bonds in the US Treasuries. That's a cheap, easy way to access that with an ETF. But anything more complex than that, longer duration issues, more credit risk, more strategic bond management. There's so many risk variables there. There's reinvestment risk, there's liquidity risk, there's obviously credit risk, and duration, which is the length of time for the effective maturity of a bond. There's all these variables. You need somebody to have some oversight on that. Playing around on the yield curve, it's difficult to do as a passive investor.
And it's funny because, you know, we often talk about how ETFs are great vehicles for putting asset allocation strategies into practice, but they might not be the best vehicle for doing certain aspects of that asset allocation.
Well, what they are brilliant for is actually benchmarking your own active work, because it gives you something that's investable to see, you know, this is what you could have won, and then actually to measure your choices against. But you know, in a sensible portfolio strategy, the best thing to do is to be agnostic and choose a mix of products and active and passive styles, and also your own stock selection.
Well, that's the end of that debate then.
Done.
No, I think it's very good, James. I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's kind of something that we've always concluded anyway. That you kind of take each vehicle as it comes, and you choose what's best for the right circumstances. Excellent. Thanks, James. Thank you, Algie. Lots more in the magazine this week. Lots of results, although that's going to start to pick up as we go ahead. Emma Power has written a great feature on the wealth management industry, which very much ties into this whole asset allocation, asset management debate that we're talking about. A lot of money going into discretionary there, and a lot of M&A. Your stock screen, which we've already discussed. An excellent second feature from Tom Dines on wealth self-help books, which is really quite interesting. Guess what it's all about again? Behavioural finance. It's as though we repeat ourselves week in, week out. the usual news, the usual comments from Simon and such alike. And you're in the economics page again this
yes,
week, James.
Yes.
Yeah, no more Trump lovings this week.
No, I mean, that wasn't really a loving of the man. It was more. I get a bit fed up with the way that the policies. I mean, economically, there is a huge risk of you know, protectionism, and it isn't good. But strategically, it's about more than economics for the US, and they're prepared to take a bit of short term pain because they're worried about their global position with the Chinese. I think that's what it's about.
I have alluded to the same tariff war in my editorial this week, because Trump this week has threatened another $200 billion of tariffs against Chinese companies on the basis that they're stealing American intellectual property,
which they are, arguably.
Which they have been for years. Yeah. I mean, they have been. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. You know, even the very largest globalist companies would say the same thing. So yeah. Well done, James. Right. Someone had to say it. Yeah. And thank you all for listening. Pick up the magazine, Slaying the Active-Passive Myth, How Asset Management's Biggest Debate is Misleading Investors. And we'll be back again next week. Speak soon.